So we've mainly been focusing on Jesus' love. Now I want to take you through some of the other terms. And imagine yourself as a contemporary of Jesus. And these are the kind of thoughts that are coming to you as you watch him and listen to him and perhaps see him die on a cross. I'm assuming all these terms are quite possible to be attributed to Jesus without the resurrection and the insight that that brings later. That's my position on this. Jesus is a poor man. Poor. Poor doesn't mean in the New Testament, it's not an economic term, though economy has some relationship to it. Poor means recognizing our total dependence on God. That we don't have in ourselves the means to meet our own needs. Our biggest need is for love, of course, and we haven't got the means of meeting that on our own. We are totally dependent. So a poor man in the biblical sense is someone who does two things, recognizes his or her total dependence on God and cries out to God in his or her distress. They may be economically quite well off, but they recognize this dependence. Or they may be, no one in their day was as desperately poor as people are today because they were subsistent living. Jesus never experienced the dreadful poverty that we see in our world today because it didn't exist. You know, where millions of people can be starving or move, it just was impossible in their world. So we're not talking, and their economic system was, they were on a barter system anyhow. So as you'd probably imagine, if you lived when I was a little kid and we used to take a pound of, you had coupons during the war, and we'd give our coupons for tea or sugar or something to Mrs. somebody up the road, and she'd give her coupons for tea to us because we drank tea and she ate sugar, I don't know what. We kept swapping coupons. Well, that was their world. It was a barter world, and there was enough food around for people to eat, which is not the same today. Right. So Jesus, the poor man, welcomed his total dependence on God and cried out to God in his distress, knowing in faith that God would hear his cry. Luke 4 reads, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me," first opening homily of Jesus at Nazareth Synagogue, "because he's anointed me to bring good news to the poor." The good news is that God does hear your cry. You are totally dependent on God, but God is loving you in this situation, whatever it happens to be that you're in. You're not alone in it. God's love is there, and God is hearing your cry. "How happy," said other poor. He didn't mean it's great to be wandering around without enough food to eat or without a shelter over your head. In fact, everything Jesus did was to stop that happening, wasn't it? One bloke came up to him, the rich young man, and said, "What can I do?" And he said, "Well, look, I'll tell you one thing you can do. You don't need all this extra stuff. Give it to the poor. Like, get rid of it and give it to the poor." So if the poor are all that blessed in our terms, do you know what I mean? Then why would Jesus muck up their poverty by giving them something? No, it means that the poor are those who... Well, I've said it. How happy are those who rely on God, call on God in their distress, and trust that God is with them, even as Jesus did in the agony and on the cross, which we go through this week. Agony. "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me." So that's what he wanted, for reasons that I won't go into now. "But may your will, not mine, be done." That's the call of a poor man. "You know best. I trust you. You're with me. That's all I need to know. So you work it out. I'd love you to take it away, but I'll always trust you're with me. On the cross, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" Feels abandoned, but still cries out, "My God," you see? Still calls out in his distress, dependent on God. So these words, my God, why have you forsaken me," which we'll hear again, no, we won't, we had it on Sunday, because they're not in John's Gospel, they're the opening words of Psalm 22. Which, after a prolonged cry, issue in praise. You've got to read the whole psalm to know what was going on. And they end up, "Praise the Lord, who did not despise the poor man when he cried out to him. He didn't hide his face from him. He heard me when I cried." That's the Jesus on the cross. And that's what he died with, this assurance that God was listening and actually heard him. A second quality, and in the tapes on the book, of course, that takes a whole lesson, that page, 2 hours of talking about poor. So everything I'm doing with you can be gone into at great, great depth. I'm just trying to give you an over-impression, that's all. Jesus is a just man. Now, just, be careful, don't go into commutative justice and all this for the moment. Just basically means someone who does God's will. That's the definition of just. Another word used in English, beautifully really, is righteous. There are two ways of translating the same Hebrew or Greek word. Righteous is quite a good word, but it's lost its currency a bit today. But righteous, if you look at it, is really two words stuck together. It means right-wise. That's what they would have said originally, right-wise person. A person who's wise as to what is right, who's wise in doing the will of God and not their own needs and desires and so on. So whichever of those words you use, that's what Jesus was like. Jesus is obedient to God's will and reveals God's justice and God's fidelity to who God is, a God who is love. Sometimes I find in my ministry, and you have people, you talk about love, which of course we've got to, and what else is there to talk about? And people say, oh yeah, but God's just as well as loving, you know. Completely misunderstanding biblical justice. You can't have be just as well as loving. Just precisely means God who is loving will always faithfully be loving. God will always act according to who God is. And a person who is just is a person who acts according to who they really are. Prime Minister, Minister for External Affairs, father, no, mother, priest, sister, teacher, we've all got our, you know, and if we live according to who we really are, that's what it means to act justly. And ultimately, who are we? But creatures of God. So to act justly is finally to listen to and do the will of God. Let's read, let Jesus speak for himself. I can do nothing by myself. I can judge only as I'm told to judge, and my judgment is just, because my aim is to do not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. A perfect definition of what it means to be just. Jesus was a just man. Jesus' mission was to make us just, to share with us his communion with God, so as to make it possible for us to act justly, meaning to do God's will. Paul writes, put on the new self that has been created in God's way, in the goodness and holiness of the truth. To do, Paul has a beautiful line, it's one of my favourite lines, and so if you like it, you can put it above your shower recess or whatever you've got at home. Do the truth in love. It's very good, excellent, it's Paul. To do the truth in love. Because sometimes people do the truth, but it's not loving. So they're actually quite wrong. They might have the right answer to the question. They might be standing up for orthodoxy, but they're not doing it lovingly. They're not listening. They're dominating. They're doing things in God's name. All through history, people have been like this. Well, someone has to get it through to them that they're not doing the truth. That's not truth, because the ultimate truth is that God is love. And some of them, perhaps closer to my temperament, do loving things but weave the truth a bit. And if a thing isn't love, if I'm trying to do something loving, if it's not true, it's not loving. You know, like, see, I don't do this, but some people do. You know, like they flatter people. They do, I see them doing it with kids. Very dangerous. They make the kids seem that they're the best dancer in the world. They're not the best dancer in the world. Don't tell them they're the best dancer in the world. Unless they are, you know. I just think truth is so vitally important. Encourage them, love them, but don't flatter or pretend, because that can only do people harm, in my view. So we've always got to be truthful and loving together. And that's what it means to be just. And if you're a kind of loving person, well, keep checking whether it's truthful. And if you're a truthful person, keep checking whether it's loving. And if one of them's missing, you got neither. They dance together. Third question. I'm doing this fast, but are you going all right? Just giving you impressions. The third thing that you could say about Jesus, he was a wise teacher and seemed to be wise. Here's some texts. I'll just run through them. Jesus increased in wisdom and years and in divine and human favour as a boy, Luke 2. Mark, his teaching made a deep impression on them because unlike the scribes, he taught with authority. Pretty good word in English. You see the word author in the middle of it? Authority means he's in touch with the author. There's only one author, that's God, the author of everything. He taught, he was coming from a place of communion with God which rang true to people and wasn't just, he was a wise teacher. It was said of you of old, said Jesus, but I say to you, now everyone who reads the Old Testament, and some people do, I do, and a good thing to read, but by heavens, you do need to do a lot of study if you're going to read it. And they read the Old Testament and muck up Christianity all the time. Because they keep putting them both in together in a big blancmange, you know, what blancmange isn't the right word, but, you know, a big mixture of stuff. And God's in everything and everything. No, Jesus said, it was said to you, but I'm saying this, let's listen to him and only read the Old Testament through his eyes and we'll see the beautiful parts of it and we'll let the rest go. The people were astounded. Where did this man get all this? What is this wisdom that's been given to him? Again, Jesus, the Queen of the South, came from the ends of the earth to listen to the wisdom of Solomon and see there's something greater than Solomon here. Paul, Christ is the power of God, the wisdom of God. Colossians 2, Christ in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Wisdom is basically, how do I say this in a sentence, but wisdom is basically not just knowledge, you know that. Wisdom is that capacity to be open to revelation, technically. The word revelation and the word wisdom belong in the same sentence. So a wise person, really wise person, is someone, everything he or she knows is taken into a place where they're open to the revelation of God. They see the world as a symbol of God. So they're open to the ultimate symbolic, which is, of course, God. New Testament, Jesus is the prophet. This is Jesus of Nazareth that they saw. They call him that. He's a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. Prophet never means someone who foretells the future. I'm not denying that the prophet may see something of the future, the people's future, the near future. But when you think prophet, don't think crystal ball and seeing the future. Prophet, the word itself even means, in spite of the English dictionary, because it's been denatured, and now it pretty well means someone who foretells the future, doesn't it? If you think of the word. But the word prophet in the biblical setting is one who speaks forth from God. It's got nothing to do with time. It's someone who speaks, proclaims, is the Latin equivalent of profemi, which is Greek. So a prophet is someone who, at the front, speaks for God in any situation. So anyone can be a prophet at any time. And of course, the prophet might also say, look, if you keep doing this, this is what's going to happen to your kids. You know what I mean? We're not denying that there's a future implication. But he's not a crystal ball person. Jesus was a prophet because he spoke clearly from God. Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. He whom God has sent speaks the words of God. That's what a prophet does. For he gives the Spirit without measure. John 6, this is indeed the prophet who's come into the world. People felt God somehow in Jesus. So, this is my son, the beloved. The words of the transfiguration. Listen to him because he's actually speaking from God. He's a prophet, in other words. John 1:18, the only Son in the bosom of the Father has made God known. That's what prophets do. Jesus in his person and in his actions and in his words is God's focal word, bringing the prophetic words of the Old Testament to their full flowering. Jesus is the servant of the Lord. And I suggest to you he was recognized as such by some people while he was among them. These are the kind of things that he was palpably so. not to everyone, but to those who are listening. Here's Matthew 12:18. Here is my servant, the servant of Yahweh, servant of the Lord. Abraham was a servant of the Lord, and Jacob was a servant of the Lord. It was a common way. In other words, someone who did God's will, really. But that's what the servant means. Watching for the least gesture, and then they do it. Here is my servant whom I've chosen, my beloved with whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim God's verdict to the nations, to everybody, not just the Jews. Acts of the Apostles, God has glorified his servant, Jesus. He's described as your holy servant, Jesus. There are four beautiful, well, you have one of them on Good Friday, called servant songs in the Deutero-Isaiah, songs of the servant. They're lovely pieces of literature, music literature, poetry, and they're applied, they really are talking, well, I won't go into that. Well, they're talking about the kind of leader that they're looking for to take them back from exile to Judea. That's what they're actually talking about. But the imagery is so beautiful that when the New Testament writers come to talk about Jesus, they find they're their favourite songs they call on to use to communicate who Jesus is. It's the poetry they prefer. So there are 50 and more allusions to the servant songs in the New Testament, which I won't do now, but have done in other places at length. Now we come to the most obscure and most important title of Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of Man. And I'll be spending 15 minutes on this, because this is quite extraordinary. The word Son of Man is only found on the lips of Jesus, and it's only found in the Gospels. There's two small exceptions. One in the Acts of the Apostles, which is just after Jesus' death. Stephen uses the word Son of Man. And there's one other one in the Apocalypse, which picks up this up. But apart from those two obscure little texts, you'll only find the expression Son of Man in the New Testament. It's never used by the theologians of the first or second century ever again, because it didn't translate. They couldn't put it into Greek. They couldn't make sense of it outside a very Jewish setting. So it only makes sense to people who are very familiar with Jewish idiom. And you don't find it. No one else calls Jesus the Son of Man, but he invariably speaks of himself in this term. So it's argued among scholars, but I would suggest to you that if you want to get into the psyche of who Jesus thought of himself as being, here's the key. He calls himself invariably, again and again and again, the Son of Man. Why did he do it? What did he mean? To find out, simply, and it's a big issue, there's libraries written on this, so if you think in quarter of an hour I'm giving you the whole truth, well, I'm not. But I am giving you, I think, an accurate summary of all that's written about it. You have to go back to the book of Daniel. Book of Daniel, written, finally put together, some of its old material, stories from the exile and so on, about Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego and all this, and the fiery furnace, and Daniel, some prophet who we only know the name back from that period. But the book of Daniel is written at the time of the persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes IV, the Syrian king, in 168 BC. So that's the period we're talking about. And it's a very important book. And it starts a whole stream of apocalyptic writings. It was like The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings or something. It spawned a whole kind of imaginative literature. Well, that's what this did. And all through the 2 centuries before Jesus and a couple of centuries after, there are apocalypses galore written. The only one in the Bible is the book of Daniel and the book of the Apocalypse, which is based on the book of Daniel. Can't be understood without it. And quotes it hundreds of times. So here you've got this. So now we've got to go back to that book of Daniel, a recent book, a book that talks about the coming of the Messiah. So a book that fascinated people, because it talks about heaven and judgment and death and all of that. One particular vision in it, chapter 7, verse 9 to 10, reads, I watched, and as I watched, thrones were set in place. It's a vision. And the Ancient One took his throne. Clearly God, eh? His clothing was white as snow. His hair of his head was pure wool. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. This is telling people what the last judgment's about, what really matters. Who's going to be honoured by God and who's not? And Antiochus Epiphanes the First would have thought he'd be the first one there being honoured. And all these people who believe the Romans and the emperors, they'll be up front. Will they be? This is our author saying to the persecuted people, the Jews, who are getting crushed by these bullies from... He's saying, don't worry about it. When the books are open, mate, you'll be the ones that are honoured by God, not the great military blitzkrieg bullies that are driving you into despair. So there's the judgment. What we're getting is a vision of the last judgment. Right. Verse 17, 13. As I watched in the night visions, I saw one like a son of man. Here's our title. Son of man is another way of just saying a human being, really. Like a son of man. It wasn't an angel. It was one like a son of man. But this has got some special stuff with it. Coming with the clouds of heaven. If you went to Mass on Sunday, you heard that, Jesus saying that to the high priest in the courtyard. He quoted this. Coming on the clouds of heaven, and he came to the Ancient One and was presented before him. To him, to the Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and kingship, and all the peoples, nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away. His kingship is one that shall never be destroyed. So all the honour goes to this one like a son of man. Who is it? That's the vision. The vision is then later, Daniel chapter 7, 27, is unwrapped, explained to the people who are reading the book. So the author himself explains the vision, and look at this. Kingship and dominion, and it goes on, shall be given. In the vision it was given to him. Here in the explanation, shall be given to the people of the Holy Ones of the Most High. People of the Holy Ones of the Most High. The downtrodden, persecuted Jews at the time of the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes. This Son of Man is a heavenly equivalent or symbol or whatever of the ordinary, broken, loving, gentle, faithful Jews that were being pushed under, persecuted. To him was given dominion, dominion given to the people of the Holy Ones of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions will serve and obey them. Do you get the link? So, that's the basic text. Now, this is Jesus' favourite way of talking about himself. The Son of Man, seen by Daniel in a vision, is the heavenly counterpart of the poor, downtrodden people of Judah, persecuted by the Syrian occupying forces. The point of the vision and its interpretation is that in God's judgment of history, it's not the Syrian army that will triumph, it's those faithful to God. The powerful stand judged by the way they treat the powerless, the rich by the way they treat the poor. In the Synoptic Gospels, this is a bit erudite, but I'll just say it and then get rid of it. In the Synoptic Gospels, when Jesus talks about himself as the Son of Man, three themes come in the texts. One is judgment, which we've seen in Daniel, haven't we? The books are opened. This is what really matters, in other words. The second is identification with the oppressed. So when Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, he means he identifies with the oppressed, not the oppressor. He takes sides with the poor, not the rich, in that sense. And the third element that you find in those quotations is it reveals God through obedience. It's the one who listens and is faithful and obeys. So Jesus, the Son of Man, means he's the one by whom we will be judged. In other words, I'll be judged by the way I relate to him, by the way I live his life, I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. You've heard it all before, haven't you? I was in prison, you visited me. So if I want to know what life's really all about and what I'll be judged on and what really matters, look at Jesus, the Son of Man. Because to him is given power and glory, and we'll come to that resurrection at our next lecture. And that's what really matters. That's identification with, which means identifying with the poor and the oppressed and the broken and being faithful to doing God's will. In John's Gospel, who also calls Jesus, calls himself the Son of Man, it's got a wider scope in a way. It includes those, but it adds, in this highly symbolic gospel, Jesus' ascension into glory and return. The Son of Man will come back, you know, and has gone into heaven. So it's got that heavenly vision aspect brought in as well, absolutely right. Judgment is said to be now in the ministry of Jesus. We're judged now, but now, the present moment, the way we treat the poor and the way we obey, etc. And the third is, in John's Gospel, the focus is on the cross as Jesus' hour of glory, judgment and vindication. You have to believe me on all that. It's in my stuff on the web, but I can't go into it at any greater length now. All those themes rightly belong to Daniel's story, and the Synoptic Gospels and John bear those out in Jesus. Now, in some texts, the Son of Man is so important that it actually corrects and gives the perspective on which all the other titles are there, including Son of God. If you go to John's Gospel, chapter 1, I haven't got it all there for you, but it's a compilation from about verse 30 onwards, after the baptism. The disciples come, and there's about five or six big titles: King of Israel, Son of God, Christ, Messiah, etc., etc. I haven't got them all in my head at the moment, but you'll find that they're all saying things about Jesus. And when Jesus says something about himself, he doesn't use any of those titles. He says, "You will see the Son of Man," and he calls himself the Son of Man. "I tell you very truly, amen, amen, I say to you, you'll see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Son of Man. The Son of Man was a vague title. Like, it's vague to us, it was vague to the contemporaries too. And can't you see what Jesus is doing? It's quite brilliant. If Jesus calls himself the Christ, everyone will think they know what he means, because they've got a lot of ideas about Christ already in their head. They'll only misunderstand him. He has to get them to get to know him and then rethink all their thoughts. So he uses a title which is powerful, beautiful, about judgment, about the poor, not unclear, but people are thinking, I wonder what he means by this, because it's a bit obscure, it's a bit something like that. And it's only discovered by exploration. So Jesus keeps correcting them. John's Gospel, chapter 9, the man born blind. And when he comes, he's at the end of the story, Jesus goes into the temple. The Pharisees all pick on him, and he says, "I don't know, I didn't see him. I was blind, and he told me to go down to the pool of Siloam and wash and all that kind of thing." And so he doesn't know what Jesus looks like, because, for heaven's sake, he was blind. "But now I see, and he did it for me." So Jesus goes in and finds him out and asks him a key question, which must have been the question asked, I think, at the baptisms and at the early church liturgies. "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" Interestingly, in the Vulgate and in some of the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, it's changed. It has, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" But the scholars are all agreed that the original text must have been Son of Man, because you wouldn't change Son of God to Son of Man, but you might change Son of Man to Son of God, because "I believe in God the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit." Like, it's almost an inevitable progression of thought. So the text in John is, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" Which is very significant. Do you believe that God judges people according to the way they treat the poor? You know, do you, all that I've just said to you. "The Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life for the ransom of many. The Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." I'm reading just text from the scripture. You will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Can you see the links with the Daniel story? The Father has given him authority to execute judgment because he's the Son of Man. He's the one who represents humanity, shows us what a man really is the icon of all of us, and shows us what humanity should be. Work for the food that endures forever, which the Son of Man will give you. The one who says, come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. The one who identifies with the poor and the broken and the oppressed. The one who hears, who knows that God is hearing his cry, and who hears the cry of the oppressed. The Son of Man must undergo great suffering. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. When you've lifted up the Son of Man, you will realize that I am the massive Greek ego, eimi, which stands for Yahweh, really. In speaking of himself, I'm just quoting my own book now for you, in speaking of himself as the Son of Man, Jesus is highlighting his prophetic mission, stressing the fact that what he reveals is what he himself has experienced in the special intimacy which he has with the Father. The title underlines the finality of God's saving revelation, as well as the ultimate judgment that is based on people's acceptance or rejection of that revelation. Above all, it stresses the spirituality of the servant of the Lord, for the title Son of Man identifies Jesus with the poor and the outcast. It focuses our attention on the cross, where we see God's love finally revealed, as well as the ultimate revelation of what it is to be a human being, a Son of Man, who is faithful to love-giving even unto